Again, this call is being recorded. If you do not wish to be recorded, you may disconnect at any time. Again, this is a meeting of the Stakeholder Advisory Board. If you'd like to speak, you can virtually raise your hand by pressing five-star on your dial pad. Again, that's five-star on your dial pad. You will then be called upon in the order that your hand was raised. Please take a moment to enter your speaker code if you've not already done so. Please remember to mute your phones until speaking. Good afternoon and welcome to a duly noticed meeting of the Stakeholder Advisory Board, the Governor's Office of Emergency Relief and Recovery. The Governor's Office for Emergency Relief and Recovery was created when Governor Sununu issued Executive Order 2020-06. That order is publicly available on the Governor's website. Today's meeting is an official meeting of the Board, is open to the public, and will be run in a manner compliant with RSA 91A. We have someone on the phone taking minutes, which will be posted to the Gopher webpage. Meeting materials for the Board and the public can be found by visiting the Gopher webpage at www.goferr.nh.gov. Again, that's www.goferr.nh.gov. And again, today's meeting is being recorded. I will help facilitate today's meeting. Because the Board is meeting by phone, under RSA 91A, there are a few initial logistics that we need before I turn it over to our Chair, Donnelly Lozo. First, each of us must state our names, where we are located, and who is with us. As we move through our agenda today, each Board member and anyone else speaking is asked to identify themselves before speaking. Should you choose to take any votes today, they must be done by roll call. For attendance, we'll be conducting a roll call in this manner. I am Joe Dorian, Deputy Director of the Gopher in the Gopher Office, 1 Eagle Square in Concord. With me is
Lisa English, Rhonda Hensley.
And we are in a large conference room, appropriately socially distanced, at the Department of Business and Economic Affairs. Now we will proceed to Board member roll call. We will go through the roll call alphabetically. Bill Ardinger.
Thank you, Joe, and everyone. Hello, everyone. This is Bill Ardinger. I'm at home and alone.
Thank you, Bill. Dean Kristen.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Dean Kristen, New Hampshire Housing. I'm at the authorities' offices in Bedford, and I am alone.
Thank you, Dean. Lisa Drabik.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Lisa Drabik. I'm in Londonderry in my home office, and I'm alone.
Thank you. Thank you, Lisa. Jim Jalbert.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Jim Jalbert. I am at my office in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and I am alone.
Thank you, Jim. Amy LaBelle.
Hi, Amy LaBelle here. I am in my home office, and I am alone.
Thank you, Amy. Al Letizio, Jr.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Al Letizio, Jr. I am at my office in Windham, New Hampshire, alone.
Thank you, Al. Donnelly Lozo.
Afternoon. This is Donnelly Lozo. I'm alone in my agency office here in Manchester.
Thank you, Donnelly. Scott Mason.
Yes, this is Scott Mason. I am alone in my farm office in North Stratford, New Hampshire.
Thank you, Scott. Michelle McEwen.
Good afternoon. My name is Michelle McEwen, and I am in my office at Speer Memorial Hospital in Plymouth, and I am alone.
Thank you, Michelle. Nancy Merrill.
Hi, this is Nancy Merrill, and I am at my work office in Claremont, and I am alone.
Thank you, Nancy. Jeffrey Myers.
Hi, this is Jeff Myers. I'm at my home in Concord, New Hampshire. One of my daughters is in the home, but not with me.
Thank you, Jeff. Holly Novoletsky.
Good afternoon. This is Holly Novoletsky. I am in my office in Greenland, New Hampshire, and I'm alone.
Thank you, Holly. Kathleen Reardon.
Hi, this is Kathleen Reardon. I am in my home in New Boston, alone.
Thank you, Kathleen. Benjamin Wilcox.
Hi, this is Ben Wilcox. I'm at Cranmore Mountain in North Conway in my office, alone.
Thank you, Ben. Donnelly, with the roll call completed, we are ready to continue with all members in attendance.
Great. Thank you so much, Joe. The next item on our agenda is a presentation from Gopher. Any updates that we have from the office, from the Legislative Advisory Board, and from the Reopening Task Force? So if you guys would take that on, that'd be great.
Thank you, Donnelly. Again, this is Joe Dorian here in the Gopher office. I'm going to just two quick things, and I'm going to turn it over to Lisa. I just wanted to let you know Director Little is planning to join us around discussion time just to help listen in and answer any questions. So he'll be joining us after the presentation. And just another side note, we were, as an office, presenting to the governor and council yesterday. If you were able to join that call, Director Little and other members of the Gopher staff presented to the governor and council, answered some questions, and I believe that's available on the executive council website. So I'd like to turn it over to Lisa for a few quick updates.
Great. Not a lot today. For the lab update, some of you may know, but just so those of you that aren't aware, the Legislative Advisory Board is working on an allocation proposal from the meeting yesterday. I believe they will be finalizing that proposal along with a cover letter on Friday. I wasn't sure if there's anything else, Donnelly. Do you have anything else from Legislative Advisory Board?
Oh, I was going to mention to the board that we have been invited to have a conversation with the Legislative Advisory Board Friday. It looks like it'll be 1 o'clock, half hour, 40 minutes or so, just to update each other on where we are and answer any questions that members may have.
Great. So a couple of other updates. One other Gopher update, we have learned that HHS is starting to put more data about New Hampshire healthcare providers that have received funding on the various congressional acts. So we'll be getting links to those sources up on our website for folks' reference. And then for a reopening task force update, there's a call going on right this very moment, and we are monitoring their work. For those of you that haven't had an opportunity to take a look, their website is at nheconomy.com/reopening task force, or I just did it by going through a Google search. But they have their minutes and agenda as well as presentations on the website. But we'll look to get a more robust update for you for Tuesday. That is all I have, Joe.
Yep, and just for members of the public, again, presentation materials for today can be found on the Gopher website. If you go to the Advisory Board tab and then the little arrow, the drop-down menu, and click Advisory Board Presentations, scroll to the bottom where the most recent meetings are. You'll see today, May 7th, the packet that went out to folks, along with the resolution that was passed at the last meeting on the 5th. So you can follow along there, and of course you can find agendas, and we're adding content each day. So please take a look. There's a lot out there, but you know, there's a lot of good information. So with that, I'd like to turn it back over to Donnelly.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it. I would like to begin our presentations by thanking all of the people presenting today, including our board member Dean Christian, for being so flexible to let us change our plans from Tuesday to Thursday to hear their presentations. Today we'll conduct it the same way we've been doing, and I'll ask Dean, after each presenter has completed, to lead off with any question or clarification that he thinks is necessary, and then we'll open it up for questions as we go through the list. So with that, Sarah, Matts, and Dustin, the floor is yours. Or not. Sarah?
Hi, Sarah, are you on?
Hello.
Oh, I think we found her. Sarah, go ahead.
Can you hear me now?
We can hear you.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Sarah Matson-Dustin. I'm the Executive Director at New Hampshire Legal Assistance.
and I'm really grateful for the opportunity to speak with all of you today, and also so grateful for the time that you're giving to our state during these unprecedented times. So thank you for everything that you're doing. New Hampshire Legal Assistance is a nonprofit law firm. We are in the business of civil legal aid, and I thought to start I would just zoom out and tell you where we fit into the broader justice system in New Hampshire. So when it comes to representation for people who can't afford to pay for it, we have the criminal defense side of the system, which is provided in New Hampshire primarily by the New Hampshire Public Defender. And in criminal cases, a person is eligible to have an attorney appointed if they're facing incarceration. NHLA works in the civil justice system, and unlike in the criminal justice system, there is not a right to have an attorney appointed in most civil cases. What we do at NHLA is help people with civil cases that impact their most basic needs, like safety, shelter, and economic security. We work exclusively with low-income people and people age 60 and over. Many of our clients live in very deep poverty. 43% have incomes at or below the federal poverty level. So for some context, that's barely more than $500 a week for a family of four. And many of our clients have other vulnerabilities in addition to having low income. For example, over half of our clients experience disabilities, and over 40% of our clients have minor children. We're a statewide program. Our offices are in Berlin, Claremont, Concord, Manchester, and Portsmouth. We travel to every corner of our state to meet our clients where they are. That added up to about 100,000 miles of travel in 2019. I'm really happy to be able to tell you that we've been able to maintain near total operational continuity during the state of emergency. We're continuing to receive new requests for services. We're continuing to take new cases. We're continuing to represent our clients. But we are absolutely in the calm before the storm. I want to make it really clear that civil legal aid, both here in New Hampshire and around the country, has never had enough capacity to meet demand. So when I talk about the surge in need that we know is coming, I'm talking about exacerbating a shortage that is acute in the best of times. And we do, unfortunately, predict that a surge is coming. I know that you're focused today on the housing sector, so I'll zero in on that as well. Housing is the largest practice area for New Hampshire Legal Assistance. That's true for most legal aid programs around the country. Housing cases make up about 40% of our cases overall. And that's because the mantra of housing first is now something that we hear across disciplines. Housing is the literal and figurative foundation for stability for families, and that's why it's always been a top priority for us as well. We're in the calm before the storm right now because moratoriums on eviction and foreclosure are staving off some of the housing crises that are to come. But there's not a moratorium on paying rent. Families remain obligated to pay their bills, including rent and their mortgages. And once the state begins to reopen and the moratoriums are lifted, many families are going to be left with significant arrearages and the threat of imminent homelessness. I know that you're going to hear today from other presenters about the incredibly low vacancy rate that we have in the state. What that means for our low-income clients is that rehousing can be nearly impossible. I know you're going to hear a lot today about the importance of direct rental and mortgage assistance, and we really strongly support those efforts. The civil legal aid that we provide is also going to be on the front line of New Hampshire's economic relief efforts. In the housing environment that we have in New Hampshire and in this public health environment, we don't want a single family to get wrongfully evicted. And that's what we do at NHLA. We make sure that evictions and foreclosures proceed on lawful, substantive, and procedural grounds. And very often, that's not through litigation. Very often, it's through helping tenants work out reasonable repayment agreements with their landlords, helping homeowners work out reasonable repayment agreements with their banks. We try to find ways to keep people where they are. So we know that the need for civil legal aid and housing is definitely going to surge, but that's not the only kind of need that's going to surge. We've outlined our projections in our written testimony, and I just want to highlight one of them orally. Our second biggest practice area at NHLA is domestic violence. We help domestic violence survivors get protective orders, so these are the orders that require an abuser to stay away from their victims. We also help survivors get divorced, get child support, get orders related to custody and visitation. And just this week, we got the data about the number of protective order cases that were filed in our New Hampshire circuit courts in April 2020, and it was the lowest since January 2019. That's something that's really scary to me because we know that means that there are many people who are simply not in a position right now to access resources safely. As the state begins to open back up, I think we'll see those filings go back up dramatically, and we need to make sure that people can access legal representation. Going to court is really stressful under any circumstances. Facing down an abuser is extraordinarily stressful. The combination of those two things is really not something that people should have to go through alone. In our housing work and our domestic violence work and the other kinds of law that we practice, what we're really doing is helping families to solve problems, helping them get back on the path to stability. And often the legal interventions that we provide can prevent more expensive problems. Homelessness is expensive. The long-term effects of the adverse childhood experience of being exposed to violence in the home is expensive. Families that have stability, have secure housing, have food on the table, have safety from violence, are families that are positioned to thrive. They're better positioned to maintain employment, to help their kids have educational success. We think of our work really as not just helping individual families, but helping entire communities. Our clients, and even people who are a little bit better off than our clients, are generally putting their money right back into the local economy. They're paying rent. They're going to the grocery store. They're putting gas in the car. So when we make sure that low-income families can stay on track and can maintain that stability, we really give a boost to the broader community. I think the bad news here is that based on the last recession, we expect the number of people who are eligible for our services to increase by as much as 20 to 25%. And in order to maintain our existing capacity, which is to say to keep the shortage of civil legal aid from getting even bigger than it already is, we would need approximately $1 million more per year until the economy recovers. I know no one has a crystal ball and knows exactly when that's going to be. What we would suggest that you consider is a $3 million fund, which would be able to be used as the waves come and go. So it may be that we see a really significant spike over the next 6 months or so, and then it has a long tail if we have a sluggish recovery. So that's what we'd like you to consider. We wanted to mention that the current funding mechanism for civil legal aid in Hampshire is the Judicial Council. I hope that you've had a chance to look at the letter from the chair of the Judicial Council, Nina Gardner. We really appreciate all of their support for the services that we provide. And I think that I'm about at the 7 or so minute mark, so I want to make sure I have plenty of time to answer your questions. And once again, thanks so much for the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Dean, would you lead us off?
Thank you, Donnelly, and thank you, Sarah, for that presentation and for the excellent written materials you provided. I want to just ask a question about one of the points you made, because I know it's come up in some of our earlier conversations, the sort of hidden effects of some of what's going on now. And you touched on it in the area of domestic violence. And can you talk a little bit about the sort of scale of activity that you're involved in there and what kinds of things you think we might be sort of experiencing as we kind of come out of hiding, if you will, going forward here in terms of numbers of clients and those kinds of things?
Sure. So with the domestic violence caseload, we actually are seeing a dip right now because people aren't able to access resources. So we are usually able to accept several domestic violence protective order cases per month and a smaller number of divorce cases. The reason for that is that a protective order case, generally speaking, resolves within a month or two. Divorce cases can often last a year or two. They are by far the most labor-intensive cases that we do at NHLA on behalf of individuals. So the unfortunate flip side of that is that we turn away more cases than we're able to accept because the size of the demand is so large. So the concern that I have right now is that the demand is going to be really compressed. So it may be that after a significant dip in April, whether it comes in May or comes in June or comes in July, that there will be this pent-up demand that's going to be unleashed all at once, and we are not immediately going to be able to take more than those several cases that we're able to take each month. So that's the real concern. I think it quantifying it is hard because we don't know whether that is going to come all at once or it's going to come in a surge over 3 months.
And additional resources would help you scale up to be able to deal with that when that surge comes, whenever it is.
Yes, and we've been thinking a lot about how we might quickly stand up some additional capacity. We don't really have any precedent for hiring a whole bunch of people all at once and then standing it down several months later. So what we've been doing is trying to think about creative ways to do that. So, for example, we've been talking to our partners in the private bar about, is there a way that we could essentially borrow lawyers from private firms who would be willing to come do a discrete body of legal aid work for some period of time? We know that the bar is ready to step up in terms of doing pro bono delivery of legal services. We have an amazing historical commitment to that in New Hampshire, but we think we really need to find a way to get some lawyers on our staff for a short term. So we're thinking about those kinds of public-private partnerships.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions from other members of the board?
Donna Lee, we have a hand raised from Bill Ardinger. Go ahead, Bill.
Thank you, Joe. And Sarah, thank you very much. Your written materials were unbelievably high quality and also detailed. They provided numbers which permit a reader, I think, to make an assessment of exactly what you're suggesting in terms of a surge risk, not unlike what we're facing with hospitals who have been required to adjust their operations to face a potential surge of COVID-19-related issues, and they need help for that. And so I appreciate that very much. The one thing, could you please speak a little bit as to how and what's very good in your oral testimony, you have identified an actual target for the surge fund at NHLA, if I heard it right, and you should correct me if I didn't, $3 million that would allow you to access the capacity to serve the surge. Could you speak a little bit more about the beneficiary of this surge capacity, which are low-income residents of New Hampshire who arguably are disproportionately being adversely affected by this COVID crisis, and how the provision of your services would enable them, your beneficiaries, your clients, to, find a path back to independence and sustainability, over a 3-year period or so. Thank you.
Sure, absolutely. So, thank you for that, for your kind remarks, and also for asking this question about the communities that we serve. So, in terms of income, we help people who have incomes up to 200% of the federal poverty level. So, that's a little bit more than $1,000 per week for a household of four. As I mentioned, many of our clients are much poorer than that. So we have it's really a diverse population of clients that we serve. We serve a lot of families of young children. About 40% have school-age kids. We serve many seniors. We serve many people who have disabilities. And our clients really vary a lot in terms of what drives their poverty. So many of our clients who have disabilities are impoverished because they're getting by on Social Security Disability Benefits or on SSI, which is the federal program for people who are both disabled and extremely low income. But many of our clients are low-income working people. So they're people who have jobs in retail, maybe in restaurants. They're often people who have irregular schedules whose hours vary from week to week. So what really probably is a through line in our client community is not having a lot of give in the budget. So our clients are often making a choice in any given month whether the higher priority expense right now is buying medicine or buying food, keeping the lights on or paying rent. And it's really unusual for our clients to be able, faced with those financial circumstances, to have a lot of savings. So what that means is that in a situation like this, there's very little for our client community to fall back on. So that's who we're serving. The services that we provide really are a way of getting people back to their baseline. So we can help, if we can help someone avoid eviction by coming up with a repayment agreement that they can make work with their landlord over time, then not only are we keeping the family in their home, which has profound financial and emotional and family stability effects, but we're also making sure that they don't, for example, lose possessions, that they don't have to switch their kids to a different school, all things that are have really significant financial and psychological costs. When we can make sure that someone who's having trouble accessing unemployment insurance, because of course we know that unemployment right now makes our unemployment numbers during the Great Recession look rosy, then that's a family that all of a sudden, instead of potentially needing to apply for Department of Health and Human Services benefits or needing to apply to their town or city for welfare, all of a sudden that's a family that is able to pay rent, is able to pay groceries. So a lot of what we do sort of stops the trickle down into the safety nets of progressively last resort. So we try to intervene in these crises, get people restabilized, and then position them to be able to move forward through the crisis.
That's a fantastic answer, and thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. I appreciate it. Joe, are there any other questions? I'm keeping an eye on the time. We're pretty much used our 15 minutes, but if there's any other questions.
There is not, Donnelly. I'll kick it back over to you, but just as a quick reminder for the next presenter, 5-star to raise your hand again, 5-star.
Okay. Thank you again, Sarah. Much appreciated.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. Bye.
Alyssa Margolin, the director of the Housing Action New Hampshire Group. The floor is yours.
Hi. Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Pardon me. Yes, I should have said good afternoon. Yes.
Thank you, Donna Lee, and thank you to all of the members of the Stakeholder Advisory Board for dedicating time this afternoon to understanding the severe impacts of the pandemic on housing and on homeless services. My name is Alyssa Margolin. I serve as Director of Housing Action New Hampshire. We're a statewide coalition of 80 organizations focused on improving state and federal policy so everyone in our state has a place to call home. Our membership includes affordable housing providers, so organizations you might be familiar with, like AHEAD and Catch Neighborhood Housing or NeighborWorks, but also private affordable housing providers as well, like Greatbridge Properties. We also have among our membership public housing agencies, homeless service providers, and supportive housing providers. We've obviously been in very close communication with our membership since the start of the pandemic. We've done some surveys, and we hold weekly Zoom meetings focused on the impacts of COVID-19 to come together and identify needs, resources, helpful partnerships, and solutions. And before I outline for you some more details about the impacts of the pandemic on affordable rental housing market and homeless shelters, I just want to ask that you indulge me for a moment as I share with you that I've been personally inspired by the heroic leadership of those in the housing and homeless services community. I've been fueled by stories of property managers who become makeshift social workers as they actively work with their tenants who are struggling to pay rent and connect these tenants in need to food pantries and telehealth services. I've heard stories of mask making with coffee filters in the early days when PPE was scarce. And just the most inspiring leadership, really, from our state's 46 homeless shelters who have prioritized keeping shelter residents safe. They had to open new sites to decompress crowded shelters. they had to provide isolation and quarantine to those exposed, symptomatic, or diagnosed residents. And they had to totally recreate meal planning and distribution because their volunteer-based soup kitchen model, you know, fell apart with this need to volunteers to stay at home. So, you know, whether we're talking about a shelter client or a tenant, you know, housing more broadly is a foundational issue, and I think Sarah referred to that in her testimony. It's hard to even envision rebuilding an economy if the housing market's unstable. You certainly can't keep people healthy if housing is unstable, and you can't address things like mental health challenges or substance use disorder treatments if housing is unstable. So that's why we're so concerned with stabilizing the affordable rental market. As I noted on NHPR's The Exchange, this radio program covered this issue recently. Unfortunately, and as Sarah noted, we are on the brink of an evictions crisis. This pandemic hit at a time when our rental market was already strained. Our lack of affordable rental supply had created a market of cost-burdened renters who were, many were spending more than half of their monthly income on rental costs. So there was a lot of vulnerability already within the market before the pandemic hit. And so add to that now, you know, severe job loss, particularly in certain sectors, and the result is a growing renter population who won't have the income to pay. I noted on that same radio program that it's really not a question of tenants versus landlords. The eviction moratorium that will soon expire may have frustrated some property owners, but it created much-needed stability in the interest of public health. The big picture that we're asking you to consider is more about the system itself, a system where, you know, both parties, you know, create a market together. Landlords and tenants rely on each other to pay mortgages, capital maintenance, and property taxes. You've heard the expression too big to fail. In many ways, our rental housing market is too essential to fail and needs your help. This is why our proposal includes a request for your consideration for a rental stabilization fund funded at $70 million to provide short-term rental assistance to fortify this weakened system and to get our rental market on solid ground again. I'd like to use the remainder of my time to raise the concerning issues facing our state's homeless shelter system, particularly our emergency congregate living shelters. You know, the bottom line is that we can't go back to crowding people in bunk beds 2 feet apart, and we need to make major changes in how we provide emergency shelter. With the support from philanthropy, the EOC, DHHS, the governor's office, homeless organizations have successfully implemented some regional decompression shelters, coordinated health screening and isolation and quarantine. But as this has gone on, we have unfortunately seen these encampments grow, these encampment sites. So that is, I think, a growing concern when, you know, community libraries close or a favorite cafe in your town close. You know, for us, that was a loss of community connection. But for a homeless person living in a tent, these closures have cut off, you know, where they eat, where they bathe, and where they get warm. I've noticed a new expression on conference calls and webinars of homeless service professionals, and we keep hearing this phrase, we can't go back to how things were. This is why we've asked for your consideration of a homeless shelter adaptation program funded at $25 million. These resources could help shelters adapt their physical spaces and operations to support these on-site public health protocols and safe social distancing measures. We also need to address this growing encampments issue. You know, you need to rebuild trust through outreach workers and get people back into shelter and safely house them as soon as possible. I'll close and open up with for questions. With a reminder for all of us that really the best way to end homelessness is through providing more affordable housing, we had started making a lot of progress and had some really good affordable housing projects in the pipeline. The financing for some of these projects may now be at risk, so we're also asking that, for your support in considering a $10 million fund to make sure that these projects that were underway can get finished and we don't end up with half-built projects and vacant lots. So thank you again for this opportunity and for considering the important viewpoints and proposed solutions from all of the presenters today.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your thoughtful approach to your presentation. Dean, would you like to lead us off, please?
Sure. Thank you, Donnelly, and thank you, Alyssa. I'd like to sort of explore a little more with you the conversation about the shelters, and I appreciate the extraordinary challenge that shelter operators have experienced in these last few months. One of the things I think is very interesting in your comments, and you've alluded to it in your oral statement as well, is really thinking about a transformational approach to how we deal with people who are in need of emergency housing, and just maybe explore a little more some of the options you think that could be sort of approached if there were some resources that were available to do that.
Thank you, Dean, for the question. It might be helpful just to zoom out for a moment and reflect on the emergency shelter system. I've been working on homeless services and affordable housing advocacy for about 10 years. And when we started, there was a big movement about restricting funding for shelters and focusing more on housing. And I think we very much, you know, endorse this theory and want to continue to move in that direction. However, over that time, we have really starved our shelter system and become a little complacent in crowding bunk beds. I don't know if any of you have toured a shelter, but they're essentially just big rooms with bunk beds very close together, and there's a lot of sharing of very limited bathroom space. And so the fund that we're proposing is to help us adapt the physical spaces. Another thing that we're experiencing right now is not only that some homeless shelter residents have left shelters out of fear and gone to encampments with very little resources, but the fact that our 211 resource cannot identify available shelter beds. Nationwide, the Salvation Army has encouraged those homeless shelters to protect those they were currently sheltering, right? Our understanding of public health was, don't keep the revolving door going. So we're not actually serving those in need. So the fund would be, you know, to deal with the capital needs, but also the operation needs that would need to happen, including things like day programming, probably education around public health, and certainly a lot of outreach needs to get folks out of encampments. I think that the municipalities have been wonderful in really understanding that we need to serve people where they are, and we, through partnerships with philanthropy, have been able to bring portable showers, portable hand washing stations, and even meal delivery to some encampments. But we really don't want these encampments to stick, right? I mean, it's not really humane for the people living there. It's not safe for the workers doing the outreach. And it certainly won't be tolerated very long by the municipalities. People will grow tired of that. So it's another use of the funds would be for that those operational and outreach needs.
Thank you, Alyssa. And I think it highlights a really critical opportunity, if you will, to rethink the way we approach that really important need. And I just want everybody else on the board to know that Alyssa and her team have been extraordinarily helpful in working with the shelters around the state over the last couple of months to help coordinate some of these really challenging efforts to try to address these issues in a way that is humane and safe and also addresses the needs, as she pointed out, of communities themselves. So thank you for that, and thank you for your answer.
Thank you. Joe, are there questions from members of the committee? We have just over 3 minutes left.
Donnelly, we have a question from Scott Mason. Go ahead, Scott.
Thank you. What is the estimated current population of New Hampshire homeless?
I'm sorry, was the question that what is the estimated current population of the homeless population throughout the state?
Yes.
Yeah, so the last point in time count indicates just under 1,500 people experiencing homelessness. The point in time count is done at one day in January and identifies people in shelters and at identified encampment sites outside. It doesn't identify people doubled up or people who have identified themselves as homeless in the school system. So the point in time count will keep that number around 1,500, whereas the Department of Education through their homeless services has a number closer to 3,500 because they count through kids who are doubled up in home. So we usually say it's a range somewhere in that area.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Joe, are there further questions?
Donnelly, we have a question from Michelle. Go ahead, Michelle.
Hi, thank you. And thank you very much, Lise, for your presentation. I just wanted to learn a little bit more. You had made reference in your document about a governor's recently announced homeless fund. Could you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yes. We've been coordinating isolation, quarantine needs, and decompression needs very closely with DHHS and the governor's office. To stand up a lot of these programs temporarily has required some funds, and the governor did set aside $3 million. That $3 million is both provided hazard pay, and in some cases, not all, but in some cases has covered hoteling costs for a short time.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions, Joe?
Donnelly, we have a question from Ben. Go ahead, Ben.
Hi, thank you, and thanks for your presentation. I had a question just about the different programs and the funding you've outlined. Is that a program that you would manage and in-house with Housing Action New Hampshire, or could you speak to that on how those funds would be managed?
Yes, thank you for the question. These proposed solutions we're proposing would be administered by New Hampshire Housing and other partners. So the rental subsidy program, just to clarify, Housing Action New Hampshire is an advocacy coalition, so we don't really administer any programs and are not asking for any resources at all for our organization. A rental stabilization fund would more thoughtfully be administered by Dean's organization, New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority. The Homeless Shelter Adaptation Program at $25 million. The capital needs, so the retrofitting of shelters that we're proposing, would make a lot of sense for New Hampshire Housing to handle that piece. However, DHHS's Bureau of Housing Supports is the one more active on the operations and services side, and that these two agencies have a lot of experience in working together.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Are there further questions, Joe? Okay.
Donnelly, sorry, our system is a little slow. It appears that we do not. Sorry.
Nope, that's okay. Thank you. Alyssa managed to make it exactly at the 15-minute mark, so thank you very much. We appreciate it. Newton Kershaw, CEO, Head of Acquisitions, Elm Grove Companies. The floor is yours.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Excellent. My name is Newton Kershaw. I am Principal and Head of Investments and Finance for Elm Grove Companies, a New Hampshire-based real estate investment and management firm. I would like to thank the Governor's Stakeholder Advisory Board for the opportunity to speak on behalf of New Hampshire's real estate and housing industries. By way of background, I am a Manchester native and a graduate of Syracuse University with majors in finance and entrepreneurship and a minor in economics. I completed a program of study in international finance and banking at Oxford University. I began my career at Lehman Brothers Investment Bank in New York City and began investing in multifamily real estate in New Hampshire over 15 years ago. Elm Grove Companies is a vertically integrated real estate investment firm headquartered in Manchester, New Hampshire, with four satellite offices across the state of New Hampshire, with one additional office in north central Massachusetts. Elm Grove owns and manages close to 1,500 apartments in the affordable and market rate apartment sectors, along with a number of retail, restaurant, office, and warehouse interests. With a staff of over 100 employees, it has property management services provided internally for its own assets, as well as being a third-party property manager for outside interests and private equity real estate syndications. Additionally, Elm Grove Companies has construction and property maintenance arms, which self-perform new construction, renovation projects, and internal maintenance. Further, Elm Grove Companies has over 20 real estate agents who work for its Elm Grove Realty Division, which has been one of the largest apartment brokerage firms in the state over the past few years as calculated by gross revenues and apartment units transacted. All industries have been hard hit by COVID-19, what I will call a black swan event. Absent governmental support for New Hampshire's housing industry, the implications to the New Hampshire real estate and housing industry will be dire. Our local, national, and global economy have experienced an historic bull market run, and it was due for a correction regardless of COVID-19. The underlying economic fundamentals for that correction, specifically for our local housing industry, however, did not point to the severity of housing industry distress that we now face. Importantly, there exists a strong supply and demand imbalance in the state of New Hampshire for housing, and specifically affordable housing, such that there is a great undersupply of said housing. The Great Recession of 2008 was born out of a housing bust that occurred as a result of loose underwriting standards for mortgages. Those past loose standards did not return, and absent a black swan shock such as we are now experiencing, there was no reason to expect the severe downturn in New Hampshire's real estate market, which can now be expected absent governmental intervention. I would like to introduce my bottom line up front and follow on thereafter with supporting information. My recommendation is that the state consider funding a residential rent stabilization program, which will provide direct rental assistance to landlords on behalf of tenants. I recommend a program sizing of approximately $70 to $105 million. It is important when considering a direct rental assistance program to understand that the program does not solely benefit tenants and landlords. Rather, it will serve a larger public benefit by averting a groundswell of distressed real estate, the effects of which will stress local banks, eviction court systems, future construction starts, and local and state tax payments receivable, and displace many of New Hampshire's most housing insecure. In order to make recommendations regarding the sizing of this program, I have spoken with over a dozen industry participants, including New Hampshire's largest apartment owners, with apartment holdings in excess of 10,000 apartments, hotel owners, bank CEOs, and regional real estate investment bankers who represent clients with apartment unit ownership in excess of 40,000 apartments. In these discussions, I represented a I represented a determined program sizing that relied on four variables. First, the total number of New Hampshire apartments, that being 189,000 units. Second, the average rent, that being $1,251 per month. Third, the expected temporary reduction in collections due to the implications of COVID-19. And fourth, the length of time through which the severe impacts of COVID-19 would impact collections. These discussions were framed in the context of the current short-term federal fiscal stimuli that are temporarily delaying the severity of collections losses. Those stimuli include one-time direct payments that were sent to U.S. citizens by the U.S. Treasury, 2, the Payroll Protection Program, which has allowed many who would otherwise have been unemployed or underemployed to remain employed for a period of 8 weeks as a result of direct payments by the Small Business Administration to companies to keep workers employed, and 3, unemployment benefit supplements provided for by the CARES Act, which give recipients an extra $600 per week, which sunset after July 31st. The conclusions of these programs will represent a time of great strain on tenants' ability to pay rent. The responses I received from the industry participants were telling, as they all told a similar story. Regarding rental collections, the consensus was that in a worst-case scenario, collections could be off 30% from normal. No participant thought that collections would be off less than 15%. Regarding the length of time that severe COVID-19 impacts would be felt, the consensus was about 1 year, taking us through the end of the first quarter of 2021. No participant thought the impact would reduce prior to year-end 2020. Regarding when the economy would more fully stabilize toward a new normal, 2022 was the resounding consensus. It is difficult to know exactly what the impact of COVID-19 will be on reduced collections and through what period of time they will be experienced. What I've attempted to do is come up with a number that is not an ask for the worst case scenario, which could be easily in the excess of $250 million. Rather, I have attempted to propose a number range that represents a floor level of funding below which we can reasonably expect that there will be a severe housing shock that will have dire implications to New Hampshire's housing insecure, local banks and their future ability to provide loans to our communities, the court system, the construction and related trades, and municipal and state tax revenues receivable. As such, I have used a 2 to 3 month period of reduced collections at 15% to conclude a program sizing of roughly $71 to $106 million as an appropriate floor to avert the full severity of a local real estate crisis. I apologize for an arithmetic error in my written submission to the Governor's Stakeholder Advisory Board, which translated to an erroneously stated range of $47 million to $71 million. Again, I thank the Governor's Stakeholder Advisory Board for the opportunity to speak on behalf of the New Hampshire real estate and housing industries, and would like to take any questions at this time.
Thank you very much. Much appreciated. Dean, would you like to lead us off again?
Sure. Thank you, Donnelly. Newton, thank you for being here, for your comments and for your analysis. Can you perhaps, as a property owner, sort of put a little bit of perspective for folks around just what the challenge is for an owner dealing with having a significant number of tenants who are unable to pay rent and what your options are, frankly, in a circumstance like that?
Sure. Thank you for the question. Well, first, I'll start by saying that to date, we as a company and other landlords in the industry have not yet experienced the significant reduced collections that we expect to see in the future as a result of the factors that I mentioned. However, when those do materialize, that's going to translate to a lower cash flow, and it's going to impede our ability to make payments, those payments primarily being to the largest expense categories being mortgages, principal and interest for those mortgages. So what we're seeing in the industry is a willingness from the federal agencies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, to institute forbearances and allow for periods of time through which a deferral of payment or interest-only payments can be made. In exchange, the owner would need to forestall any eviction proceedings for 120 days, which is not out of line currently with the moratorium. Local banks I've been in touch with are also understanding of delinquencies that they expect. One banker is expecting 15 to 18% delinquencies across a portfolio, which is not just multifamily, but across all sectors. And so proactively willing to work on forbearances with those borrowers who are creditworthy enough to make those payments. But ultimately, an inability to make those payments is going to lead to the banks taking on distressed real estate situations that will propagate through the market.
And Donnelly, if I can just follow up, and Newton, in the end, as a property owner dealing with a tenant, you can work through those processes, but ultimately, as we have heard earlier today, the option obviously is to move to evict the tenant if you can't work out some kind of a payment plan that works for both you and for your lenders and others. And that's obviously something that's not happening now, but it has big implications clearly for the court system and for you as a business owner and others. Is that not the case?
That's totally the case. I think one of the challenges is once this moratorium is lifted, to the extent that there are arrearages or back payments owed, workout agreements are going to be the prudent thing for owners to work on with their tenants, but there's a period of time through which they're going to need to make up those arrearages, and with tenants already paying so much of their disposable income towards rent, if they get behind 3 or 4 months and you have to tack that on and pay it off in the remainder of a lease term in 6 to 12 months, that can put quite a burden on that tenant and make some challenge situations as it relates to eviction proceedings.
Thank you.
Thank you. That exchange was helpful. There's about 2 minutes left on the clock. Are there questions from other members of the board?
Donnelly, we don't have anybody that's pressed 5 star as of yet to raise their hand, but we'll give the system just a second to catch up.
Donnelly, this is Bill Ardinger. I could have a question if there's a minute.
Okay, there is.
Thank you for your testimony. I wonder whether you could describe the people who are the renters in the program, what their income levels are generally, and would the program that you're talking about allow for conditions like making sure that workout agreements, forbearance agreements must be in place across a spectrum of renters? Thank you.
Sure. Well, I mean, I haven't given program specificity really the thought, but in pointing to other states that have implemented certain programs like Arizona and Delaware, there certainly is a pointing to lower income tenants. One of the programs referenced those that were making 80% or less of area median income. So I think that those are the people that are most housing insecure, and programs should give due consideration towards those types of tenants as opposed to a broad brush, equally giving out monies to those who are in need.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Further questions, Joe?
Donnelly, it doesn't appear that we have any hands raised.
Okay. Thank you, Newton. You finished 20 seconds early. Appreciate
Thank
your
you.
Time and your thoughtful presentation as well. With that, Attorney Viscarello, the floor is yours.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Like all the other presenters, like all the other presenters, I wanted to thank you for letting me take part in this process. My name is Ken Viscarello. I'm a partner in the Manchester law firm of Sheehan Finney Bass and Green. My practice is concentrated in the area of affordable housing development. In the past 20 years, I've represented public housing authorities like the Rochester Housing Authority and Dover Housing Authority, and not-for-profit and for-profit developers in the development of over 100 affordable housing projects using tax credit financing. I also volunteer in the nonprofit housing community. I'm the immediate past chair of the board of directors of the Concord Area Trust for Community Housing, commonly known as CATCH, and I'm a member of the NeighborWorks Southern New Hampshire Resource Development Committee. My testimony is going to be a little bit different than all the prior presenters, as I'm going to be focusing more on the development side and the folks who develop affordable and construct multifamily affordable housing. I'm here today to talk about the financing challenges that multifamily affordable housing development will be facing in New Hampshire as a result of the COVID-19 crisis. In particular, I will focus on the low-income housing tax credit program. I know that Chairperson Lozo and Member Kristen are familiar with the low-income housing tax credit program, but for those of you on the board who are not, in New Hampshire, the majority of multifamily affordable housing for families and for seniors is done through the low-income housing tax credit program. Without the tax credit program, the state will not be able to make a dent in the already high demand for multifamily affordable housing. The tax credit program is a federal program, but it's administered by the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority, who, because that's such a mouthful, I'll refer to as NHFA the rest of the way through the presentation. Each year, NHFA gets a finite amount of tax credits from the federal government to award and allocate to developers in New Hampshire to construct multifamily affordable housing. Once a year, the developers submit applications to NHFA to receive tax credits, and generally anywhere between 5 to 8 projects are awarded tax credits each year. Once a developer receives an award of tax credits, they go out and sell the tax credits to an investor in return for cash or equity to put in the project. This cash or equity never has to be repaid. I think the best way to think about it is almost like a down payment on a house. The more of your own money that you can put down, the less you have to borrow. The smaller amount of debt on a tax credit project as opposed to a market rate project allows the developers to charge lower rents and to target lower income families and seniors to occupy the units. In return for buying the credits, the investor gets a dollar-for-dollar reduction in their federal tax liability for each tax credit dollar that they buy. But there's generally a catch, because even though they get a dollar-for-dollar tax deduction for each tax credit dollar that they buy, they don't pay a dollar to the developer for that tax credit dollar. They generally pay something less than a dollar for each tax credit dollar that they buy. Before the outbreak of the coronavirus, investors were paying about 88 cents per tax credit dollar. So if a developer had $1 million allocation of tax credits, he would receive $880,000 from the investor. The gap between the tax credit dollars and the total project cost to build a multifamily apartment is generally filled by a combination of other funding sources, including commercial loans, home funds, affordable housing trust funds, and CDBG funds. However, the amount of these funds is limited, and the competition for them is fierce. With the drop in pricing for tax credits, the gap's only going to get wider, and there are a few sources in New Hampshire to provide funding to fill that gap, which will result in a decrease in the development of multifamily affordable housing. The effects of COVID-19 development will have on multifamily housing is starting to cause a great degree of uncertainty in the tax credit market. Over the past couple of weeks, I've interviewed a number of tax credit investors, consultants, and other folks involved in the industry, and they're all basically telling me the same story. The investors in the industry are anticipating a drop in pricing for credits of an amount up to 10 cents per tax credit dollar. So where a developer might be getting 88 cents for a tax credit dollar pre-COVID-19, that developer will only be receiving around 78 cents per tax credit dollar going forward. And this is being caused by a number of factors. Most tax credit investors are banks, and a lot of banks are having their own financial setbacks, and they're taking a wait-and-see approach before investing in any new projects. There's still a number of other investors out there, like insurance companies, but with the decrease in demand for tax credits, the investors that are left are able to decrease their pricing. There's also a concern because existing projects under construction and projects that will be commencing in the near future are anticipating facing delays caused by the coronavirus. Due to shutdowns and social distancing requirements, most developers are anticipating that it's going to take quite a bit longer to get the projects completed. This will affect the price paid by investors. Investors can't take credits against their income until the projects are ready to be occupied and placed in service. The longer it takes for the project to get placed in service and open, the more the investor's yield or rate of return decreases. So this is also going to have a negative effect on driving down pricing for tax credit dollars. The last one of the other issues, and the last one I wanted to talk about today, is that there's a concern about the effect the coronavirus is going to have on the production of raw materials. Most of the developers feel like there could be, if not a shortage, at minimum a delay in receiving the construction materials necessary to construct these projects. In a compound matters, most folks are thinking that there's going to be an increase in pricing for construction materials. Again, the delays or shortages are going to cause the equity investors to shy away from putting dollars into affordable housing, and the ones who do will be able to pay a reduced rate for each tax credit dollar. The tax credit program has currently constituted as an important program for the state of New Hampshire. Tax credit development plays a vital role in the state's economy. First and foremost, it's the most effective tool to make a dent in the housing crisis and provide clean, safe homes for working families and the elderly. Second, these projects provide jobs, not only for construction workers, tradesmen and suppliers, architects, engineers who build the projects, but to the folks who work on compliance and supplier and management once the project is complete. One thing that's very important to understand is that these projects aren't cash-rich projects. It will be difficult to find alternative sources of funding to fill the gap caused by lower tax credit pricing. The state needs a source of funding to provide additional capital to fill the funding gaps caused by the decrease in pricing paid by investors for each tax credit dollar and the additional cost by anticipated cost increases for materials and supplies. I believe the best way to tackle this problem is to allocate some of the funding to NIFA to use for this for the purpose of providing financing to multifamily affordable housing projects for working families and seniors. It would help to have a fund of money to offer no interest or low interest loans or other forms of financing to developers of affordable housing to fill the funding gaps that will be created by lower pricing and higher cost. I think it makes sense to allocate the funds to the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority, as they are already overseeing the home program and the Affordable House Trust Fund program, and will have the mechanism, safeguards, and procedures to get funds in the hands of low-income housing developers. Thank you for letting me make this presentation. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Much appreciated. Dean?
Well, thank you, Ken. I guess it's probably helpful if you can take a moment and explain to folks why it is that a developer can't simply, in the context you're talking about, can't simply recover these additional costs by, say, raising rents when the project is completed, or by some other mechanism that might seem obvious.
Sure, Dean. That's an excellent question. Rents are we call them LIHTC, low-income housing tax credit rents, are generally set. And most of the projects either, you know, are charging right around maximum rents, and the rents cannot be pursuant to Section 42 of the Internal Revenue Code more than 30% of a tenant's income. So it's not as simple as just raising the rents or deferring any fee. There's also a section of the Internal Revenue Code that prohibits organizations like yours, Dean, from overfunding these projects, and you also have got a finite amount of funds. I believe this year it was about $3.5 million, but that in connection with the Internal Revenue Code, Section 42M, says that in general the housing credit dollar amount allocated to a project shall not exceed the amount the housing credit agency determines is necessary for the financial feasibility of the project. It's not as simple as just, okay, we'll bump up the rents and we can take back these costs over time. What's really needed, you know, I think as I've stated, is that these projects, you know, they don't produce a ton of, as you know from underwriting them, they don't produce a ton of cash flow. So it's not as simple as just jacking the rents to get more cash flow to cover the holes in the funding.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have about 5 minutes left. Are there questions from members of the board?
Don Lee, we have a question from Michelle. Go ahead. Go ahead, Michelle.
Thank you. And thank you for your presentation. I just was wondering if you could explain to me how volatile the low-income tax credits are. I mean, obviously you're seeing them go down, or the market value of this going down, but with reopening, hopefully with a resurgence in our economy, how quickly would those rebound, or how, like I said, how volatile are they?
Sure. We faced a similar situation back with the recession in 2008 and in 2017 with tax reform, where they dropped the corporate tax rate. The demand decreased a little bit. And that demand on both of those were a little bit different. In 2008, the tax credits bottomed out, I would say, for almost 3 or 4 years, and it got to a point where, as part of the 2012 Recovery Act, that states like New Hampshire, all states, were able to monetize their tax credits by turning them in, and that kind of kept the market in getting cash to loan out instead, along with some other funds called TCAP funds. They were able to keep the market going till about 2012, when it started to rebound. In 2017, when the tax reform passed, the volatility dropped probably, you know, about 6 to 8 cents per tax credit dollar. That time it rebounded a bit more quickly because the need and the, you know, the issues with the recession weren't the same. It was just that banks and other institutions had a lower corporate tax rate, so the demand wasn't there. But as over the past year, year and a half, they've come back to where they've kind of started in the high 80s, low 90s. I think on this time, you know, I think, and also just to be blunt from actually talking to some of the investors I know, some of them are opportunistic. You know, they see this uncertainty in the market, and even if, you know, there's no reason for them to decrease it, they're going to try to increase their yield or their rate of return on their investment. And that's what they're all telling me, too, is all the yields, you know, people want to see the yields go up. And that's going to force a, you know, a downward correction in the market for tax credits.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions?
Donna Lee, we appear to have, we'll give the system a moment, but we have no hands raised.
Okay. Thank you very much, Attorney Viscarello. We much appreciate your presentation.
Thank you for letting me take part.
Of course. Next, Evelyn Welton, Senior Vice President, Retail Lending Sales Manager. Evelyn?
Thank you. Thank you, Donna Lee, and thank you to the committee for taking this time. I am here today representing both Bank of New Hampshire, but also the Mortgage Bankers and Brokers Association of New Hampshire. I serve as their president this year, and I worked with our membership to come up with the proposal that we put forth to the committee. I think I have to tell you, I'm alone in my home office. So the MBBA New Hampshire represents New Hampshire lenders, both depository and non-depository, title companies, insurance agencies, and the like, supporting home sales in New Hampshire. Our primary focus is really working towards maintaining a sound financial economy around home ownership. We want to help families have a healthy, safe, and stable living environment to ensure that they can actively participate in their communities. We recognize that with any economic downturn, some folks simply will not be able to maintain mortgage payments. This will stress the family's housing, which is a primary anchor, i.e., the roof over their head. Nationally, forbearance or the ability to not make a payment in a particular month is at about 7%. I don't have April's numbers yet for the state of New Hampshire, but I can tell you that as a servicer in New Hampshire, we're running at about the 5% mark. So a little under the national average, but still concerning considering we've only gone through one cycle under the CARES Act with this forbearance allowance. And May has just brought that second month upon us. Many in the state, many homeowners don't understand what forbearance means. They know they're in trouble. They know there's an option. And they're going to take it. That's what we do to survive. They don't know how it works. And they don't understand the payback around the payments that they have been allowed to put aside, for lack of a better term. In fact, some smaller servicers that we have talked to are also struggling to understand forbearance because forbearance has a different meaning depending on who owns your mortgage. So again, that makes it difficult for a homeowner to navigate this system. Add to that the CARES Act foreclosure moratorium, and we've got another component here in needed relief in the state. So the moratorium, when it is lifted, will create some additional pressure on the system. I was listening to other folks talking about the pressure in the rental market once the moratorium on eviction is lifted. We're going to see something similar in the foreclosure realm. So we all know that if a homeowner is struggling and they need to sell a home, not only could they avoid foreclosure, but usually in trying to make that sale, there are also some maintenance and repair needs. So if someone can't make monthly payments, they're usually also going to struggle to pay for any required maintenance. Foreclosures often flood the market with homes that are difficult to finance because of their condition. Again, seeing things get layered one on top of the other, those things all adversely impact our New Hampshire economy. So our proposal is to get ahead of this issue. We'd like to see some stability provided in the housing market by allowing those in financial trouble to have that option to sell rather than end up in foreclosure. We'd like to see counseling provided to maybe help navigate them out of that foreclosure space, or if there's no option, help them more quickly get to that foreclosure space, as sad as that is, and keep things moving. So based on knowledge learned during the Great Recession, we know that early intervention via education and counseling can mitigate unnecessary stress in the homeownership realm. It's our desire to see similar relief as we saw back in the 09 to 012 2012 crisis. We'd like to see similar relief deployed to ensure that as many New Hampshire residents as possible may stay in their homes. So the organization is concerned about the impacts of COVID-19, and we're looking to see that the working model of 211 New Hampshire, which is the Home Help New Hampshire line, stay in place. This is a central option for intake and referrals. It allows homeowners to have a quick, easy access to educated personnel who can tie them with the organization closest to them and help them work through either forbearance mitigation with their lender, foreclosure mitigation with a lender. If the lender is not a federal lender, like some of our small New Hampshire servicers, it may lead to needing relief to help actually back out of foreclosure. I think we saw back in the last Great Recession, many private, I'm going to call them private label lenders, offering some relief to mortgage balances in order to lower monthly payment obligations. That's certainly not first on the list, but we do have to recognize not all mortgages are federally backed. Recovery is the second piece of the puzzle. Recovery is really dealing with how we look at the housing market as we move forward. So what happened to the average New Hampshire resident during the downturn period? We're going to have credit problems because people were unable to make payments. We're going to have savings that now are limited, if there at all. So we've just experienced 10 really good growth years. Our residents have done a great job at being able to save. In fact, Americans saved 13% more in the month of March than they did in the month of February, and that's simply because, as good consumers, they knew they needed to tighten their belts. That said, those monies saved are going to go to pay bills where they don't have income coming in to offset it, and savings will be depleted over the course of the next few months. So our proposal is really looking at dealing with relief now. How do we maintain the most stable housing environment on the home ownership side through the downturn And then how do we help low to, I call it low to moderate income home buyers, which is 50% of our population, as we move forward? And so if you take a look at the numbers, we're asking for $5 million to go towards relief, with some targeted at pre-foreclosure counseling, monies targeted at the 211 intake and referral system, outreach and communications. So if we don't actually reach out to our communities and tell them that these services are there, they won't be used. And we do believe that communication is a critical component of this proposal. And then again, I talked a little bit about those non-federally backed mortgages, $3 million or so in a pool for that purpose. From the recovery perspective, we're looking for about $16 million to go towards down payment assistance. Again, not a new program. This is a program that New Hampshire Housing has facilitated for the state for as long as I've been lending, which is, I don't want to tell you, 30 years. but I've been working with New Hampshire Housing and down payment assistance personally since 2002, and I know how successful it is to help folks get into home ownership. With $16 million, we could help about 2,570 households purchase homes over the course of the next 12 to 18 months, or as soon as the economy opens up, to be able to see that happen. When we talk about economic stimulus to home sales, what does that equate to? About $533 million in home sales and $552 million, I apologize, I have those numbers reversed, $552 million in home sales and $533 million in loans. All of those stimulate the New Hampshire economy. Add to that the $3.2 million in fee income that comes through lenders and go back out to our communities, the $10-plus million that generates for the state via transfer tax, and it really goes to show how an injection of funds into a targeted place can actually drive economic vitality in the state. In regard to emergency home repair and the ability to mitigate foreclosure by having appropriately maintained homes, we're recommending $4 million be set aside for that. We do see that as a revolving fund. There is no reason why a homeowner couldn't put a new roof on, for instance, in order to be able to sell their home and then pay that money back to New Hampshire Housing with or without a small interest stipend added to it. But again, having some sort of revolving fund to help mitigate foreclosures by allowing those homes to be sold quickly rather than foreclosed on because they weren't well maintained. In closing, I guess I would say for us, it's about those two things, relief and then recovery. And the real key is to manage both of those before the market gets out of hand. And I really believe, based on what I saw during the Great Recession, that this state has the ability to do this and do it well. And I believe strongly that New Hampshire Housing is the appropriate organization to manage that effort, if you will, on behalf of the housing industry. Thank you.
Thank you. Dean, would you like to lead us off again? Thank you.
Evelyn, thank you, Donnelly. Evelyn, I just want to have you focus for a moment perhaps on the relief component of your proposal, and really perhaps from based on your experience, talk a little bit about what the broader implications are of significant numbers of foreclosures to the housing market, if you will, and to home prices, to neighborhoods, to things of that nature, because I think that's largely what we're all trying to avoid here. But maybe you can tell us your perspective on that, having worked through that.
Absolutely, Dean. Thank you. And one of the reasons, Dean, to your point, that I commented on families having a healthy, safe, and stable environment to actively participate in New Hampshire communities is because that is what homeownership does. And when you begin to see foreclosures creep into neighborhoods, you now have homes that are owned by banks, whether they're local or from afar. They are homes that don't have any activity there. That home value has just gone down via the foreclosure, and it begins to bring down the values of the homes next door. And so if my home was foreclosed on, it's probably not in the best shape, as I mentioned earlier, and maybe it was a $200,000 home and the best we can get for it at foreclosure is $175,000, okay? Now when the house next door sells, that house is going to use this foreclosure sale as a comparable, and it naturally pulls down the appraised value of that house next door, even if the buyer and the seller have agreed on a higher price. And so, Dean, if you and I agree to sell the house next door for $200,000, but it only appraises out at $175,000, I can assure you there will be a renegotiation on the sale price of that home. And so if you picture that rolling from home number one to the house next door to the house next door to that, you now see this ripple effect of home values being depressed. It takes a long time and a lot of cash infusion into a market to begin to push those values up again. And that's exactly what we saw in the Great Recession. It took a long time to have comparables, i.e., what did my neighbor's house sell for, that were high enough to support the higher values that demand was bringing to the table. A couple of things happen, Dean, when values are depressed like that. Not only does it impact the numbers I mentioned earlier for home sales and the amount of money that they pump into our economy, but bigger than that, I look at tax bases and things of that nature. So the lower the value of the home, generally the smaller tax bill they're paying. I realize that mill rate comes into play there, and the mill rate can change. But we all know that as towns lose asset value, generally speaking, it's much more difficult to meet those mandatory payments, and so you might see school budgets being cut, and you might see town services being cut. You will see fewer volunteers in your community. It's a huge ripple effect. So I hope that wasn't too much and answers your question.
Thank you.
Thanks very
Donnelly.
Much. You're welcome. So we have used all our time there, but if there is a burning question that needs an answer, Joe, do you see one? Can
Donnelly,
you tell from the hand raising if it's burning?
We had a hand raise from Holly. Go ahead, Holly.
It's not a burning question, just a quick question. Evelyn, I think you did a really nice job in structure and process of getting funds out. You talked about the CARES Act only addressing the federally backed mortgages, leaves a third of the people out. Does that include manufactured homes, or is that number actually higher?
You know, there are not a lot of manufactured homes included in the federal mortgage pool simply because many manufactured homes are not considered real estate. In New Hampshire, we are fortunate that we recognize them as real estate, but again, federal national lenders do hold the majority of mortgages in the state of New Hampshire. And so that means that those mobile homes, even though manufactured homes, even though they were in a state that considers them real estate, were not allowed to be mortgaged under those terms. So they are with private investors like Bank of New Hampshire and Meredith Village Savings Bank and Franklin Savings Bank and, you know, smaller community banks that wanted to be committed to the housing market.
So they won't get relief under the CARES Act.
Well, we are offering relief under the CARES Act. but it doesn't mean that every lender has to offer that. That's the challenge. So we're offering it, but if another lender is not, they can't be forced to. Does that make sense?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
And Donnelly, if I may, I'll just sort of quick clarification there too, is I think Evelyn's completely right about the fact a lot of community banks have done lending in the manufactured housing space, as has the Community Loan Fund, but there's also a lot of non-bank lending in the manufactured housing space, and I think the sense is that they are going to be a lot less likely to follow the sort of forbearance and other requirements of the Federal CARES Act than lenders, real lenders, might be. And so there is a risk to those borrowers that really is not addressed by the CARES Act.
Thank you, Dean. I think that probably clarified it. Okay, with that, thank you so much, Evelyn. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Next on our agenda is Chris Norwood, broker owner of the Norwood Group and chair of the Public Policy Committee for the NHAR. Chris.
Well, thank you, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Fantastic. My name is Chris Norwood, and I'm the 2020 chair for Public Policy for the New Hampshire Association of Realtors. I am a commercial real estate agent and a small business owner in the state for the last 17 years, born and raised here as well. While I'm here representing the thousands of commercial and residential realtors in the state, more so I want to talk on behalf of the homeowners, commercial property owners, and then also the small business and apartment renters that occupy those spaces. I think Evelyn and Newton helped ground some of the discussion that I would like to present. In comparison to the Great Recession, there's still solid fundamentals that we've been underwriting in purchasing and on the financing side over the past few years. In the Great Recession, I was personally performing workout valuations for out-of-state lenders that had commercial and apartments, and I can tell you firsthand knowledge, the fundamentals on the underwriting was just not solid and not well-grounded. Unlike today, we have a solid foundation, but this is, as Newton said, a black swan event. On the residential and single-family condo side, we're still in a housing crunch. We've all talked about that. Prices have remained high. The April data shows that both prices and volume is up, and the pipeline, however, of under agreements is down. And this is kind of what we expected, that the April closes were really a result of February and January's under agreements, if you will. It takes 60 to 90 days to work through a close. We're now seeing the effects of some of our surveys, which say that sellers are pulling their homes off the market, buyers are delaying their home searches. Still, when a property goes on the market, evidence suggests that it sells quite quickly. However, folks are just slowing down the amount of velocity through the pipeline. On the supply side, there have been some challenges. To echo a little bit of what Attorney Viscarello was saying, there's supply side challenges for new apartments. For single family lot developers and contractors, there's liquidity challenges from their banks and also delays from planning and zoning boards for the months of March and April, while they started to ramp up an online subdivision approval process. That takes time. Shifting onto the commercial side, this is where we expect the greatest amount of impact. If you think about the data to be collected, there isn't a great report that I can pull that shows the amount of non-payments either currently or expected through the system as a result of office, industrial, and retail tenancies to their landlord. Preparing for today, I interviewed a number of property owners and a number of property managers, and the evidence suggests that somewhere between 30 and 50% of all retail tenants have either not paid either April or May's rent, or conversely have sent a letter to their landlord requesting abatement of the same. So that's on the retail sector. On the office sector, it's lower, probably around 10%. and even lower still on the industrial side, probably around 5%. This spans local and national tenants. These are the downtown storefronts and, you know, your regional strip mall on your favorite rural Sunday driving road. We've also unfortunately seen some closed for good signs. You've read those in the newspaper, and those are sad, and we expect more of that. All of those non-payments and the closed for good, we feel, are going to put a constraint on payments for mortgages, payments for real estate taxes, and other what we call CAM fees, common area maintenance for snow plowing and utilities and those type of items. We do expect there will be some evictions and foreclosures once the executive order number 4 is removed. And we expect that to create some additional pressures on the court system that's already been discussed on this call. So we do believe that mortgage payments may be in jeopardy. I would like to correct one thing that was in my written testimony that was reflecting in the national TREP data that stated that the non-payment rates on hospitality jumped up to 20%. It should have read jumped up by 20%. So not nearly as alarming as my written testimony would suggest, but still a concern nonetheless. We do not yet have the May data for the national mortgage data. Getting back to these local commercial tenancies and property owners, there were stimulus funds through the PPP and the EIDL. I can answer questions on it, but basically a lot of those funds either didn't turn out as promised as perhaps the EIDL was, or had challenges in the delivery, such as the PPP, and also could not be used specifically for, a small portion only could be used for occupancy or other real estate-related means. So anecdotal evidence suggests that a lot of folks who have taken these funds will be good until perhaps June, but then beyond June, when the PPP runs out, they're really left with uncertainty on how they want to move forward and do they want to accumulate some more debt. So overall, we're concerned that the stimulus did not provide enough for these businesses and property owners, some of which will be closed and more forthcoming. And we're concerned of what this will do for both mortgages, foreclosures, and also real estate taxes getting back to the cities and towns. So we have a few recommendations, some of which have pivoted since I provided the written testimony, because we've kind of watched what others have been putting forth. So the first recommendation is a smaller one, and I have not prescribed a dollar amount to this, but as businesses look to open, we are appreciative of the reopening task force and the PDFs and the information on reopening, but we're curious if there could be some funding perhaps directed towards business and economic affairs to provide some training or maybe a legal hotline for business owners and property managers on how to safely open up their businesses and properties. We do think that there will be demand for folks with questions that is just not it's needed beyond a static PDF. Our recommendation that we put forth in our plan was talking about some sort of tax payment relief whereby you would get a credit if you were paying your real estate taxes. We understand that the stimulus funds may have limitations to being used in that fashion. And while if future opportunities arise, we would champion that because we think liquidity to the cities and towns is important, we recognize that it might not be as applicable today. So the two new recommendations that we would like to strongly urge you to consider that you have already heard from, the first is from the BFA. In their targeted industry relief, this would provide some liquidity to tenancies in the market. It was a loan program, I believe, that was capped at $100,000 initially, with up to $50,000 of it forgivable under certain circumstances. The piece that I would like to also urge, which maybe goes beyond what they had originally suggested, is that this would be moved for not only non-essential businesses, but also essential businesses. While clearly the largest impacts are on the barbershops and the hotels and the restaurants, many businesses that were deemed essential still cannot make rent payments. We've seen this, and again, it's mostly anecdotal evidence. I do not have any statistics, but it is out there. The other recommendation we would like you to consider is the Mortgage Banker and Brokers Association putting forth about $25 million worth, and just to touch the high levels, the pre-foreclosure counseling, the down payment assistance program, as well as the emergency home loan repair. Those are other items for the single family market that we do think that will provide a softening of some of the damage that could come out of this. And with that, I'll conclude and entertain any questions.
Thank you very much, Chris. Dean?
Well, I was actually going to ask before the final comments whether Chris thought that the BFA's proposals around assistance to small and medium-sized businesses might address some of his concerns on the commercial side, but he's essentially answered that. I guess I'll ask him a similar question to what I asked Evelyn, which is, you know, Chris, what do you think the implications could be for the broader markets in terms of foreclosures and reductions in values if we don't do something to intervene to sort of make sure that those kinds of more dire things actually happen?
There's certainly going to be some diminution of value, you know, regardless of foreclosure, right? There's uncertainty and speculation. The concern comes, in my mind, obviously, real estate taxes, and as we all know, typically we never see real estate tax foreclosures because usually the bank steps in. But ultimately, you're going to start seeing some short sales and you're going to start seeing some foreclosures. And I don't think it's going to be widespread across all asset classes, but clearly hospitality and retail are going to be those two that are hit the most, and single family in certain sectors as well. And again, I think that the one piece that I stress is this is this could be geographic neutral, right? I mean, there are markets that will be rebounding quicker than others. But if you're a small retailer and you own your own property and you've been your restaurateur, you can only make so much money in takeout. We've heard somewhere between 20 to 25%, maybe even less, of your gross revenues if you're producing takeout. So how long can you survive until, you know, you put the keys on the table is unfortunately what it is, Dean.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dean, and thank you, Chris. Are there other questions from members of the board?
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Bill. Go ahead, Bill.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you very much, and thank you for your thank you for your testimony. You mentioned a couple of times in your remarks that, you know, the owner or renter has a bunch of cash obligations, you know, maybe mortgage, maybe rent, maybe property taxes and other things. You mentioned that property taxes, if a way could be structured consistent with the federal guidelines that could assist property taxpayers make their property taxes payments and keep current, thereby helping the municipalities, that also serves a positive interest because they have cash available to meet rental obligations and avoid, you know, going down that path into property tax liens and things like that. Could you just, you know, comment on if it could be structured, would that be a good direction for these funds to move in?
Certainly, and thank you for the question. The quick complicating factor is that many commercial leases are structured where sometimes the tenant pays the taxes, sometimes they pay it directly, sometimes the landlord pays the taxes. But leaving that part of the mechanism aside, if there's liquidity into the market to offer some sort of rebate fund, the landlord and tenant can use their lease document to govern that. What we were brainstorming was some sort of voucher program. It's something we heard about, and I can't cite the source from whence it came, but somehow if you could create something that says, yes, I would, Mr. Town, the city official, I'm coming to you with my voucher that says I cannot pay my $5,000 property tax bill, and that ends up filing as a lien on the property, until there's a refinance or a sale event, but it would not accrue interest, or perhaps it would accrue nominal interest, then the city and town could take that voucher and cash it in with the stimulus funds or whoever the backer of those dollars would be. And then ultimately, those dollars would get repaid back upon the refinance or the sale, because that lien would be in position somewhere at the Registry of Deeds. So that was the mechanism that we kind of brainstormed. But as you pointed out in the question, we'd have to understand if that mechanism could be replicated here in the state with these specific funds.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there further questions, Joe? We have about 50 seconds left.
Donnelly, we don't have any hands raised.
All right. Thank you very much, Chris. We appreciate your presentation today and your willingness to change your schedule for us.
Absolutely. Thank you all, and enjoy the sunshine today.
Thank you. With that, Dean, you're up. Why don't you do your presentation and wrap us all up? Would be great.
Sure. So I am mindful of the time and the amount of time that folks have been here listening to people talk about housing and real estate and related matters. And so I as at Donnelly's request, I did do a couple things. First, in addition to asking the folks who came today to speak, we did reach out to a couple of dozen other organizations and individuals, got their input, much of which has been also provided to the Gopher team, and kind of tried to synthesize their thoughts and summarize them in the memo that I provided to folks. I'm not going to go through that in detail because I'm assuming people have had an opportunity to look at it and probably don't want to hear me talk a whole lot more anyway. Couple things, though, that I do want to stress. First, I didn't address in my memo some of the issues that came up in Sarah's earlier conversation on part of New Hampshire Legal Assistance. I do want to observe, as someone who's been working in the housing space for a long time, that they do provide a really critical service in the context of not just representing individuals who have challenges, but also helping to ensure that things get resolved many times in a way that avoids litigation and evictions and things of that nature, and that in the end is good for everybody. So to the degree that that didn't come sort of through that presentation clearly, I want to reinforce that. As far as the specific proposals that people have brought forward and we are kind of summarizing here, I guess I would touch on those that I think are from a relief perspective, again, keeping in mind that our role is to make recommendations about how we might use CARES Act money for relief and recovery from this pandemic. On the relief side, clearly the preeminent thing here is this question of rent stabilization. And this is not just an issue that is kind of on the radar screen in New Hampshire. People across the country are focusing on this. The Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard just released a report that really focuses on this as a kind of coming tsunami that needs to be addressed in some way, because once we get past some of the short-term emergency funding that has been provided to renters, many of whom are people that were very much at risk before this unemployment surge, many of whom are people in the industries that are most heavily hit by the unemployment surge, there is likely to be some significant reduction in their ability to pay rent and a substantial increase in delinquencies on the rent side. And that affects not just them, but also the property owners, the communities in which they live, as you have heard, and ultimately could lead to a significant impact on the courts. So some type of effort to provide short-term temporary rental assistance targeted to people whose incomes were reduced as a result of unemployment related to the crisis, and to make some sort of connection, as I think Bill pointed out earlier, to ensure that there's some kind of reciprocity, if you will, between the property owner and the tenant in terms of what kind of behaviors we're going to expect from both parties, I think is really a critical thing to at least consider. Clearly a big ticket item, given the numbers of people that it would impact, but I think it's also very impactful not to do anything about it, or would be. And so something worthy of thinking about in that context. An important thing to keep in mind is that in New Hampshire, by law, if an individual is unable to pay for their housing needs, It is a legal obligation of the local government to assist them. And so we've not really talked about that, but in this context, people who really can't make their rent payment and are at risk of eviction have the right to go to a town welfare office, and that could raise some significant costs for communities that are already very much under stress at this point. Also, in the context of relief, I think it's important to focus on the foreclosure intervention conversations we've had. The implications for the state's real estate markets, for property values, for communities, and are as equally important as they are for individuals who are at risk of foreclosure. And as Holly's question pointed out, a significant number of people in the state, it may only be 30% of people who have mortgages, but that's not an insubstantial number. And many of those are people who have manufactured homes that they have purchased with a mortgage, and they're not likely to have the same kind of benefits that people who have federally supported mortgages do under the CARES Act. It's important to make some provision to protect them and to help them. And in any event, investing some money in foreclosure-related counseling services, we know from our recent experience with the Great Recession, is just critical in and of itself, because forbearance in the end is deferral. It's not forgiveness, and people need to understand that, and they need to understand that at some point they're going to have to make provision to make those payments. And understanding what their rights and obligations are in that context is a critical part of making sure that people don't make a mistake and end up in a very serious situation. I would also call some of the comments that Ken Viscarella pointed out as part of our relief effort. You know, not only 2 months ago, I think it was, we were talking about how we had this critical shortage of workforce affordable housing in the state, and the governor had made that a priority, as had the legislature. There was a lot of energy and effort going into trying to expand the supply of that housing. What I think you've heard here is that there is a significant threat to the ability of that community to actually deliver some of that housing that is already underway. And yes, part of it's related to the capital markets and things that are going on there, but the reality is that those projects are not in a place where they can just generate capital on their own. They need some additional assistance in order to be completed and to basically support the future of the state's economic recovery, which they are effectively part of. And then I want to focus just very briefly on the homelessness issue. I think that Melissa was very eloquent in her comments about the challenges that community is facing. And I don't know how many people on this call have actually had the opportunity, I guess I would call it, to visit a homeless shelter. But they use their real estate, I guess for lack of a better term, very efficiently, or at least they have historically. They need basically to put a lot of people into a relatively small space. They need to use a common meals areas and things of that nature. That just doesn't work anymore. And they have been forced to take extraordinary measures in the short term, which have been very costly to those providers. And I think one of the things she's pointing out is goes back to something we talked about a week or so ago when we were hearing from folks in the nonprofit sector talk about the need to really fundamentally rethink systems and how we deliver services going forward. This is a place where that's really obvious, that we can't continue to do things the way we have historically done them here. And that's going to require an investment both in operating resources and in some capital expenditures for those organizations and entities. So with that, I just want to make one last comment, and then I'll stop talking and answer any questions if people have them. I mentioned at the end of my memo that there is a network of providers that could implement many of these initiatives, or some or all of them, if there was a decision to fund them. A lot of people have mentioned my organization. I appreciate that. That may well be because they knew I was on the call. We are not the only entity that does this work, and I would envision that if some or all of these initiatives were to receive funding in the end, that there would literally be a network of organizations that would be necessary to implement them, and that includes public entities like New Hampshire Housing and the Community Development Finance Authority and the Department of Health and Human Services, but it also includes a range of nonprofit organizations across the state, the community action agencies, the Community Loan Fund, local housing development and service organizations that have a lot of experience in doing this work, a lot of experience in working with these client populations, and perhaps equally important in the context of what we've been asked to do, a lot of experience in implementing federally funded programs effectively and with a high level of accountability and transparency. So for what that's worth, I think it is feasible for us to work together as a community to figure out how to do the things that people have suggested we might do here. And with that, I will stop and attempt to answer any questions.
Thanks, Dean. I appreciate it. You put together a really great, interesting day and a perspective I think most of us can understand, even those of us not in that business. Are there questions from members of the board?
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Bill Ardinger. Go ahead, Bill.
Yes, and my apologies to the board members. I'm sorry I'm asking too many questions, but Dean, I wanted to say just a great presentation and had a great group of people here and really appreciate it. When I saw in your presentation an estimated, 152,000 renter households and thought about this kind of a robust rent stabilization program, I was really struck with, and you've addressed it a little bit in your conclusion, about whether it is possible to set up a program that can process applications fast enough to get this aid out the door at a pace that meets the need. And so I'd like to see if you could address two things. Number one, how long do you think it would take to put together that the program documents and the alliance or network of folks? Two, do you think that New Hampshire Legal Assistance, it sounds like they provide an advisory component that is pretty helpful because maybe they get the first call from a renter who's in trouble. And then finally, last question, our colleague Scott Mason has been asking, and Scott would probably ask this himself, but I wanted to do it because I think it's a great question. What are the administrative costs, do you think, of administering these programs and setting up the program delivery? Thank you.
Sure. So I think there's a number of partners that could be part of an outreach effort and part of making such a program work. And I'm not going to deny that this would be a very significant effort and a challenging one in many respects. But you have community action agencies around the state that already administer, admittedly at a much smaller scale, some emergency housing resources in partnership with the Department of Health and Human Services, and they could be a key partner in delivering these resources. We have some capacity to work directly with clients as well, and we have the ability, we think, to build an online platform fairly quickly that would allow us to interact with them, and I think there are other partners as well. So I don't think you would do this with a single entity. You would do this with a network of organizations that have the capacity to work with a lot of people fairly quickly. I don't know that I can tell you, Bill, exactly how long it would take to get set up. I think our estimate has been that we would need a few weeks at least to get organized and to begin to start taking applications. And I think like any other large-scale effort, there might be some sort of time to ramp up once you opened up the door, but I think that's frankly going to be true of any of the large-scale relief efforts that we're talking about here. In terms of New Hampshire Legal Assistance specifically, they are a really important point of contact. Another would be 211, which is, I think, sometimes an underutilized or underappreciated resource that I understand has seen a significant uptick in calls from people who are trying to understand where they might be able to get housing-related resources. In terms of cost, To be honest with you, a lot of that depends on what the scale of funding is that is available to do this, because that's then going to impact how many people you're actually going to be able to touch and how big a network and how many folks you're going to need to make that work. I would anticipate that some of those partner organizations are going to need some resources to do this. But in terms of, frankly, the efficiency of these networks, they already operate a range of programs with relatively small admin costs associated with them, by which I mean under 10%, in most cases under 5%. And I would anticipate that there would be the ability to sort of make that happen. I don't believe we'd be looking at substantial admin costs in the context of the size of the program we'd be talking about here.
Thank you very much. Great job.
Thank you. Are there further questions from members of the board? Doesn't sound that
Donnelly,
way.
Donnelly, it doesn't appear that we have any hands raised.
Okay, great. Thank you again, Dean. Very much appreciated.
Thank you.
The next item on our agenda is discussions regarding recommendations, which we've decided to maintain as a standing item on our agenda. And when we, on Tuesday, we passed our first recommendation, which laid out basically, I think the easiest way to say it is it put a narrative to slide 6 in the PowerPoint that we discussed on Tuesday. And one of the items that we discussed a little bit further was this idea of recommending funding for supportive and advisory entities to allow them to build capacity to assist in services, helping businesses, including nonprofits, have a plan for success, which we actually heard a little bit more of today with recommendations of different presenters today saying, you know, we are going to need the help and support of others to get people's best foot forward, to counsel them, to support them. And when I talk about that, I talk about the business sector, which includes for-profit and not-for-profit, but I also include in that the supporting entities for families and kids, as I like to say, when the doors open. And so having an opportunity to build up capacity at those organizations to be able to manage what might be heading their way. And we heard again today from legal assistance, you know, other groups like SBDC, the regional development corporations, a lot of different organizations. So I wanted to take the opportunity to revisit that from members and see if there's support for that. So with that, I will ask Joe to keep an eye on the hand-raising, and let us know if anybody would like to weigh in on that.
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Holly Noveletsky. Go ahead, Holly.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that I think we need to move forward on a more rapid basis on some level. If we can do it maybe on two levels, I do like the recommendation that we work with the existing channels to get the funds out. But I think the issue of life safety, especially as highlighted today on housing, food banks, shelters, charities that support our most vulnerable, I think the finances need to get out, the funding needs to get out in a quicker level because it's already going to be 2 months before they get any relief at the earliest. And I just wonder if we can identify a area priority as we move forward in this process, that there's a channel that is prioritized and may be expedited with funding.
I guess I would say a couple of things. So as we look at the work that the Legislative Advisory Board is doing, they have selected a group of sectors. They have, from my perspective, and we'll learn more tomorrow when we talk to them, based on dollar amounts, I think they've, in essence, set priorities. I think also money that has come in outside of the CARES Act has been going out to organizations doing some work, for instance, child cares, things like that. maybe not at the scale that people would like to see. I think part of the work that I am trying to encourage amongst our group is developing those processes to make that happen. So by saying, hey, yes, we agree with government getting some of that money out in direct fashion. We agree in distribution entities. And I'm hoping what that does is give Gopher and the governor an opportunity to say, let's get those groups started. Get an application developed. Get the support groups in place. Let's start making these things happen. I think that there are other steps that our group can take. I think we're a little bit, couple of weeks behind the legislative group in when we started our work and getting our information in. And I would certainly open it up to others that want to chime in on the same conversation, including Commissioner Little, who I think Joe mentioned at the beginning was going to be available during this discussion process. But maybe we can get a few folks weighing in on these different things and try to collectively respond. Does that make any sense?
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Jim Jalbert. Go ahead, Jim.
Hi, Donnelly. I think that the presentation we had on Tuesday about using intermediaries is spot on. I want to reiterate what I also said, that, you know, through some of the federal programs, there are some concepts for applications in place, and I think all of the respected sectors need to look at that if we're going to, if the governor and Gopher moves forward in choosing these intermediaries, to look at how we would get the funds out in an expeditious manner. The problem's going to be, there's going to be a certain level of, there's going to be a certain amount of a leap of faith with the applicants in doing this, and as you know, some of it, you can have blowback from some of it. We've seen it with PPP with some fraud. We've seen it in other areas. But I really think that what you put out on Tuesday is the right way to get this done in the most expeditious manner. The other thing is we have to be mindful that some of these organizations who would be intermediaries also are going through some pains related to COVID-19. You know, if you take Health and Human Services, you know, they're processing unemployment claims. Their people are working overtime. I mentioned the New Hampshire Department of Transportation. They're going through the same thing and have incurred a great level of expenses. But yet, as you and I have chatted here on this venue about lesser transit systems needing money, that list continues to grow. Just while we were on this call, I received 3 emails today about it. So we have vehicles in place to get the money out. I think we need to support Gopher and support Gopher, Jerry Little, and the governor in moving in that direction rapidly, as Holly said, because there are people in desperate need.
Thank you, Jim. Joe, are there others?
Yep. We have a question from Dean Kristen. Go ahead, Dean.
Thank you, Joe. It's not really a question. It's really a comment, Donnelly. I agree with the basic thrust of the decision we made the other day, obviously. And to be honest with you, regardless of whether there's a decision by this body and the governor ultimately to put any money into the housing sector, I, as a potential intermediary, would argue that it makes sense to use existing structures and organizations to try to get this done as much as possible. I would also give you the perspective of someone who might be in that place. And it goes back to Bill's point, which is there's only so much planning and organizing you can do until you actually have a sense that some resources are likely to be available. And so whether it is in the housing sector or in the business relief sector or in the nonprofit relief sector, there has to be at some point some indication that, yes, there is a likelihood that some resources are going to be committed, and here's the sort of scale and here's the priorities, because then people can go away and actually figure out exactly what the challenges are going to be in doing that work and come back with more detailed plans of execution to Gopher that the team and the governor can then conclude whether they meet their expectations. So I guess what I'm saying in that context is I'm agreeing with Holly's point about the need for speed, in the sense that at some point we need to start perhaps deciding on some focus points, some sectors of some kind of priorities, however you want to define it, for the use of these resources, and then perhaps identifying the primary intermediaries that are likely going to be used to address those issues, and sort of send those folks off to actually start doing some of that work.
Right, they are going to need time to build up capacity to figure out the best way to do it, to reach out to their partners, the supporting entities, and others. I absolutely agree. Joe, anybody else?
Donna Lee, we have a hand raised from Michelle. Go ahead, Michelle.
Great, thank you. I mean, I think we are all still in agreement of trying to use these entities that already exist, and I also agree with the sense of urgency. Just a question for the meeting tomorrow with the legislative board. I know they've already recommended or are going to recommend some funding by sectors, but I don't know that they've had a conversation about how to distribute. And would it give us some momentum forward if we had the conversation with them about this is how we're thinking of a mechanism for distribution? And would that then give these other entities a sense that, yeah, we've got to start getting prepared to address Dean's issue that he just raised?
I do think that they have if you look at some of the sectors that they've talked about, they have talked about specific distribution entities that they think are capable of doing it. So I think that they are on a similar path. And I did send our PowerPoint presentation to the chair of the Legislative Advisory Board, so we had a sense about how we were kind of looking at the process, and I think that that's part of tomorrow's discussion. You know, what are they doing? What are we doing? Where are we on the same page? I mean, I think if you look at the legislative document, there are some sectors that are not represented there, and that may be intentional. There are some that we may think of. We may find our priorities would be aligned if each of us took a look at that. My hope is that after the discussion tomorrow, I can formulate something that makes sense to get out for everybody to think about so we can come to Tuesday's meeting with probably a better handle on how are we recommending and what are the parameters that we're going to talk about, and are we going to look at dollars amount, are we going to look at sectors, are we going to look at timing and phasing, are we going to look at conditions, are we going to look at, you know, the administrative cost issue. What are some of those things that we want to make sure we at least raise for Gopher to either take that recommendation and move forward or come back and ask more questions or ask us to dig deeper on something? I do think it would be important to have some structure to where we're going at the same time that we're listening to more information. Joe, would anybody else like to weigh in? Is the commissioner there and interested in weighing in any way?
So Director Little joined us at the beginning of the discussion. Hi. How are you, Donnelly?
Hi. I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And I'm extremely grateful. I've been listening for about the last 10 minutes, I guess. To your conversation, and I'm instantly struck by the contributions that all of you are making to this process. And the state of New Hampshire continually amazes me with the level of civic involvement that we enjoy. And I think back to Donnelly. I think I've known you my entire adult life.
I think you're right.
And our orbits keep intersecting time and time again, so it's pretty amazing. And the last crisis in 2008-09, Dean, I think you and I were fairly well connected for quite a bit of time on trying to figure out how to get through the mortgage crisis, so that the fact that we're all still here and we're all still contributing and helping the state of New Hampshire through difficult times and moving forward is amazing to me, and I'm just extremely grateful for it. So thank you all very much for what you're doing. Joe and I have been talking since we first got here, not today, but back weeks ago, about how we were going to mesh up the Legislative Advisory Board and the Stakeholders Advisory Board. And paramount for us was getting a start on things because of what Holly just said, is the pain and the suffering is real and it's out there right now, and we've got to distribute this money as fast as we can. And so we just decided that, you know, let's get these boards up and running and get the conversation underway. For a variety of reasons that are entirely unimportant, the Legislative Advisory Board is a week or so advanced in its process, and so I think it arrived at its preliminary decisions a week and a half or so sooner than you folks have, and I hope that the net result has not caused any angst or disappointment with the Stakeholders Advisory Board meeting. I think your conversations and deliberations, and you've used a different style to attract and receive comments from a wide variety of members and segments of both society and the economy, is going to really add greatly to the richness of the results that we present over to the governor. But we're at that point where the gears aren't quite meshing nicely. We might be grinding a little bit as we try to bring the LAB and the SAB together to start working, as I guess we're doing tomorrow afternoon when we have a joint meeting of both boards. You know, ultimately, it's the governor's decision, and we're going to make recommendations to him as to where we believe the money will make the biggest impact in helping New Hampshire recover from COVID-19. But ultimately, it's his decision. So we're making recommendations. I think you're right, Donna Lee, that the LAB has, in essence, prioritized what it sees as the needs by the things that it put on the graph that was initially drafted by Senator Morrison, then embraced by Senator D'Alessandro, and then the entire group worked to try to put some dollar figures to it, to add additional details so that they're also looping in links to the variety of federal sources of funds that are available. But I think they're also aware that they haven't hit all of the important points. A great example of that is the fact that at the end of our LAB conference call yesterday, I don't recall who it was, but somebody said, hey, wait a minute, we haven't done affordable housing yet. We haven't done housing-related issues. And then lo and behold, today your presentation covered those housing needs. And so what I'm saying, I guess not very eloquently, is that I think the two boards are going to end up creating a body of work that will give the governor very strong guidance as to the big key areas that need to be addressed. And then I think it's up to you as this group continues to talk to make recommendations about what sort of specifics should we look at. That's how I see all of this working, and I hope that maybe if it doesn't clarify things, at least confirms for you how you also thought that this process might shake out. I think a lot of the hard work is now going to happen within the Gopher staff as we try to come up with more specific ideas about what the grant programs and other sorts of methods for distributing funds, what they should look like. You've mentioned since I came in the room, I guess now 15, 20 minutes ago, that you think that we should be using other agencies other organizations out there that are well recognized and have a high level of credibility and experience distributing funds in the state of New Hampshire, and that's a direction we've been moving in for some time now. We reached out a while ago to many of the organizations, all well known to you, the CDFA, the BFA, the Charitable Foundation, the Center for Nonprofits, a number of others, and said, look, you have expertise, you have professionals on board already, you have experience that we don't have and we're going to need, and there's no way that we're going to be able to put out thousands of grants and do that credibly and get the money targeted to the right people on our own. So we are definitely going to be suggesting to the governor that he rely on those mechanisms that are out there that have are well-seasoned and have professional staffs and are and the ability to put the funds out in a responsible manner. You know, if you just think about it, if we're targeting that we want to put out 4,000 grants to small businesses across the state of New Hampshire, coming from a banking background, I got some sense as to what that's going to take. And I have no desire to hire 30 loan underwriters and a servicing department to make sure that that money gets out there responsibly. But I do think that the BFA and the CDFA and the Charitable Foundation and all of the other groups out there, not only do they know the people that are on the ground that are doing the work in the communities across the state of New Hampshire right now, but they have the mechanism that's been providing funding through that network for decades. And I think our strong recommendation will be that we continue to rely on those important members of society and the economy to get these funds out as well.
Well, clearly no single entity has enough bandwidth to make it happen, and we know what happens when we send everybody to a single pipe and it can't manage what's coming through. I think the I appreciate your comments, and I think that I look at the legislative group who rolls up their sleeves. They're used to making policy. They're used to saying this, and this how much. This group, from my perspective, and I certainly do not know all the members on the group, but I have a sense of what they do. You have a strong group of leaders who have run their businesses from small to large, organizations from small to large, who are accustomed to being presented with a problem and finding a solution, and easily will reach out to others that they know can help them quickly find solutions to imminent problems. And so I think that there's folks feeling a little bit like we're in neutral and we're holding up the process. Your conversation gives me some sense that we're not holding up anything and that we're bringing something to the table, even if it's through our discussions and through people responding to our questions that we set out there.
Absolutely. You're not holding anything up. We need a process that New Hampshire feels has been transparent and that they've had a fair shake to have their say. And I really believe that we needed both of these boards to get that broad channel out there to listen to New Hampshire, to really feel the suffering and pain that's out there, to understand where the money goes, Donnelly. You're not holding anything up. You're absolutely helping build this and adding to the process.
So one of the things we talked about at our very first and second meetings were our job is to give you information to make your job easier when you make recommendations to the governor. So it would be, I think, important for us to probably continue with hearing from folks, but I think it would also be important for us to feel like we can make some recommendations that can inform your work as it relates to some of the things that we've talked about today. And I'm just trying to figure out how to get there and how to make sure all the members of the group get their concerns on the table for us to kind of pick up, turn around, and look at. And I think the format makes it an additional challenge because we're not sitting in a room together where we feel like we can roll up our sleeves and run down a checklist. I mean, Al last week or Tuesday was talking about, you know, a voting process with 100 points and, you know, scoring things. And I think ordinarily you could do something like that if you're in a room together and you get kind of quick results. And but I think this format makes that a little bit more challenging. So maybe what maybe there's an opportunity here for members to send to me things that they want to make sure we find a way to talk about. And I can map it out for the next few meetings to try to get some traction. That might make some sense, I think.
I think it makes an awful lot of sense. And I also think that this is going to be an ongoing process for a little while. If you look at the document from the LAB that they discussed yesterday, you'll see down at the very bottom that they're recommending that the governor be told to move on a chunk of the funding by the end of the month of May, but that they want to come back in June and put out another 15% in July and put out another 15%. We don't know where all of this is going. I mean, we're hoping that pretty soon the numbers plateau when we're told that the deaths from COVID-19 stop and that the new positive tests start to decline. But we don't know what's going to happen when we reopen businesses or, you know, when they open the beaches, or are people just going to stream across the border and, you know, things could take a turn for the worst. And so we're suggesting at the LAB, and it's up to you to decide whether or not you agree, but that we move the money out in chunks. As Holly said, that we need to put some money out now because people are hurting now, and then regroup and figure out where did we hit the mark, where did we miss, has the new hole opened up that we need to call some other people and ask them to come and make presentations to the Stakeholders Advisory Board and the Legislative Advisory Board so we can inform the next decisions we need to make. I don't think it's that there's a the first quarter may be over or coming to a close, but there's a long time to go in this game, even though we're really under the gun. To put all this money out by December 30, that's a big task.
I was just going to, when you talk about the December 30th, so we had talked multiple times now in our group about, you know, appropriate phasing, you know, as I often refer to, the trauma patient that we need to stop the bleed because that's the immediate need, you know, as Holly's pointing out and others. And then we have to know kind of what's recovery look like and what do we not know is going to happen next, as you're saying, and then what does the future hold? But it also begs the question, I mean, some of this speed isn't just about the immediacy of stopping the bleed and starting the recovery. It's also understanding what spend means for that December deadline and whether that might change when things start moving in a certain direction. So getting the money out, does that mean it's a spend? Or does whoever you get it out to have to spend it? So if a loan or a grant goes out, whether it's forgivable or not or whatever it looks like, once it goes out, does the entity that receive it have to have spent it by December 31st, or the entity is the state that's received the money that then gets it out? And I know there's been some guidance, and I know that you guys are digging in deep on that, but it would help to know that as well, I think, at some point.
Agreed. We hoped that the updated guidance that came out on Monday would give us more specificity on that. Unfortunately, it really hasn't. So what we're left to do is to go back to other guidance in federal law as to limitations on how federal funds can be used. And so our current interpretation, and we will always remain open to listening to differing opinions, but our current interpretation is that the money needs to be spent and dedicated to a COVID-19 relief and recovery project by December 30. Not just that we've let's just use, let's say we use the BFA as an example. Not just that we agreed to put $100 million into a fund for the BFA to grant out over a period of time, but that those grants need to be made by December 30th, not just that we've sent money to the BFA to do it.
No, but the grant made by December 30th or the grant made and the entity receiving the grant spent by December 30th?
The grant made to the entity that is spending the funds needs to be done by December 30th.
Okay.
We don't believe that all the money needs to be. We feel we can make a grant to Small Business A on December 29th, and the goal has been met. They may take a week or two to use that money to disinfect a motel room or something. But we don't believe that everything has to be. We don't have to have a receipt in hand for every expense on December 30th. There is an out period built into the proposal that we are required to understand what happened to all the funds within a certain period after December 30th, but we don't have to have that knowledge in a filing cabinet on December 30th.
And one of the one of the differences between government, right? Government has to have spent the money in a different way. With businesses, an allowable use can be loss of revenue. So if the loss of revenue happened before December 30th, so for example, if it happened, that's an allowable expense. So it's a little different when you're looking at government versus businesses.
Right. I understand that. So because I'm also thinking you get a business that gets funds, and so they're going to try to, fill that loss of revenue for the 2 months or 3 months they're closed, however that plays out, right? So they want to fill that so they can start, at the ready. Then they deal with whatever the changes they have to deal with for the recovery piece of what it looks like going forward. They're at a third capacity, a half capacity, whatever that might look like. But you also want to make sure that they have money to go, okay, if I ever go through this again, if next year at this time we're in the same boat, here are the things that I've spent some money on to make sure that I'm ready for, business continuation, continuity, that kind of stuff. So knowing that they don't have to necessarily spend it all by December 30th because they have to have time to experience these things and use the money as we're describing. So that's good to know. I think the last thing that might be helpful at some point is one of the things that we are consistently hearing from people responding to us is that they are very concerned about getting their workforce to come back to the ranch, so to speak, right? So there are very different experiences for different people. So people that were employed at a low wage job are now making more than they would make if they were in their job. And so getting them motivated to come back is a challenge. It might be the first time in a long time that they have income that's maybe really straightening out their life. They're paying off their credit card debt or they're, keeping up with their rent or their mortgage or, whatever the case may be. They are worried getting them back. Unemployment has been designed as a system that says, we're not going to pay you your full wages because we actually want you to, go back to work or find a new job or, all of those things. Right now, that scale is not the same, and the extension of that is having an impact. So we're consistently hearing from people, what if they don't come back? I'm not asking you for an answer now, but what I am asking is I think the demographics of knowing what that means and where that's happening and having a different effect than other places might be helpful in informing how we can support businesses in getting their employees back. And I don't know that anybody's done that work yet, but my understanding is the $600 has been extended into July. And so knowing what that might mean, I think, could help us as well. All the groups involved, whether it's the reopening task force, the legislative group, or our group, I think it would help us to know what that demographic might look like.
I'm glad you didn't ask me for an answer to all of that problem because I don't have one done.
Well, we've got time to look right now, but but I think we should probably know, right?
Well, I mean, we're hearing that concern slash complaint from every corner that the unemployment benefit has been made so rich that it's going to be hard to get people to come back unless something changes in that. But I think I'm going to leave it to Commissioner Capatas and Deputy Labors to figure out what the answer to that question is. Although I think, interestingly enough, we may bump into it in some of the programs and responses that come out of the Gopher office. For instance, I didn't hear all of Dean's presentation. I read some of the materials this morning that were submitted in support of it. And there are concerns that because the governor issued the eviction and foreclosure moratorium, some people may have just decided that they're not going to pay their rent. And we see it on TV all the time that there are rent protests. What worries me is that people are going to say, now I need rental assistance. Well, if they've been making more as a result of the unemployment situation than they did in a normal paycheck and they had no problem paying their rent then, that kind of leaves us with the question of if somebody had an increase in their income and for whatever reason stopped paying their rent, what mechanism is there going to be in place to make sure that we don't have fraud and abuse coming from, and I recognize this is a hard conversation to have because we're talking low-income people who just struggle every day as a matter of course. But if the decision was made not to pay the rent because the governor said there's an eviction moratorium and the net result of the unemployment benefit was they had a higher weekly income than they had before, what sort of tests are put in place for rental assistance programs?
Well, and as somebody who has spent almost my whole adult career outside of public service serving people of low income, it's not
right.
Just always the people of low income, because you've got a group that, because they weren't yet employed or they were in training or school or any of those things, aren't
Absolutely.
Receiving unemployment and are in trouble. But there's also, when you talk to the banks, as you know, the deferrals on people's credit cards and car payments, and those are not necessarily the low-income folks. They're the people somewhere else. And so sometimes people don't, as we all know, make good decisions no matter who you are. But that's another opportunity for the helping groups, you know, such as mine and other community actions and other housing, you know, groups that are out there to work with people and talk to them about making these decisions. And some of us have been proactive about it. But I'm just saying that knowing the demographics of where that falls may help inform the work of where we're supporting people and how we're helping employers get their people back to work.
I agree with all of it. I guess I was just saying that this $600 bump in unemployment that has people have higher income at this point in time that we've all agreed keeps coming at us from other directions, including businesses saying it's going to be hard for me to hire my people back because they're doing better now than they were when they were working for me. While I'm going to leave that to the people at Employment Security to figure out the answer to that problem, I think these groups are going to end up needing to discuss it as well when they talk about how do we put assistance out there that is fair, that $600 bump in the unemployment benefit is going to loop back in. But I think it also points to the value of things like Dean mentioned, you know, supporting 211 and the professionals that, and like you, Donnelly, who help people work their way through it to explain what the situation is.
Right, and I think the same can be said for businesses, right? If they're collecting, if they're able to get grants from other sources and they come back for more money through this, that has to be taken into consideration too. To me, all these groups are yeah. related. It's the same issue amongst the businesses, for-profit and non-for-profit, and the families yeah. and, you know. So it's I think it's all the same that we have to look at it, and it's a problem that can be happening in all three categories. So I've monopolized the whole conversation. Let me open it up to see if any of the members of the board have questions or anything for you that they would like to ask as we're yeah. well beyond our time. Joe, anybody have a hand up that wants to participate?
Yeah. Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Jeff Myers. Go ahead, Jeff.
Thank you. We've gone well over time, as you just noted, Donnelly, so I don't want to belabor the discussion. A quick question and then a very, very brief comment. My question is, and maybe I missed it, and I apologize for missing it, but is there call information that's made available to us for tomorrow's meeting with the legislative group, and can you remind us what time that's going to be?
So the my understanding, having talked to Senator Morse, is we will join them at the start of their meeting tomorrow at 1 o'clock.
Okay.
And what we've talked about is basically updating each other on our work, where we are to date, and then allowing questions to be asked from our board to their members or vice versa. I don't think there's anything formal. But what I will do is I will make sure that the document that they have on their agenda for tomorrow, you know, the sectors and dollar amounts, I'll send that off to members, just like I've sent to Senator Morse, you know, our PowerPoint discussion template from Tuesday. And
sure.
that might help stimulate conversation.
Sure. And is that also going to include the call-in number that we need?
Yes.
Thank you. In
You're
my
welcome.
Very brief comment, thank you very much. And my very brief comment at this late hour is that in light of all the discussion that I've heard the last 20 minutes or so, half an hour or so, which I thought was very helpful in kind of raised some of the issues that I wanted to raise myself, what you talked about, Donnelly, and what Commissioner Little talked about, I think my only ask would be that we reserve some time at our next meeting on Tuesday to talk more as a group about our process for how and when we would make recommendations.
Thank you, and I agree.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you very much.
Donnelly, this is Joe, and just to Commissioner Myers' point about the call-in information, we'll send that around. Please note to the board members, it will be different than the call-in information that you receive from SAB meetings, so just please, when the email goes out, just double-check. Just so we can avoid a delay with the start of the meeting tomorrow. Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Dean.
Thank you, Joe. That was actually a ways back in the conversation, so it's probably not a good use of people's time at this point, except at some point, Jerry, I'd love to engage you in a conversation around this issue of when the dollars can be defined as being spent. Have some thoughts on that based on, you know, some experience with other federal resources, both in our context and I think some of the work that the BFA has done that might be helpful. So, but I don't think it's necessary for us to do that right now. Thank you.
Thanks, Dean. Anybody else? Joe.
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Nancy. Go ahead, Nancy.
You know, you've covered everything I was going to ask, so I'm all set. Thanks.
Then I feel better about monopolizing the conversation. As you listened into a conversation between myself and Director Little. Anybody else?
Donnelly, we have, it looks like the last hand raised from Jim Jalbert. Go ahead, Jim.
Director Little and Donnelly, thank you for answering my question. I'm sorry. Sorry about that.
Oh, no. Please don't be sorry. Like I say a lot, this group has a wonderful perspective and a lot of life experiences that are helpful to the work. It's just a matter of trying to give us the opportunity to have the discussion similar to that what we had on Tuesday, which I'd like to find a way to have next week again. And so any of you that have, you know, process things that you want to put on the, you know, on the table for discussion, if you get all those out to me by the end of the week after tomorrow's joint meeting, I will, as I've been trying to do, formulate a path to that discussion so everybody has an opportunity and we can maybe, you know, chart a course for kind of what's next in the next week or two to come. That would be helpful. Okay, with that, unless somebody raises another hand, under other business, I think we've pretty much covered that. Our next meeting, aside from the joint meeting tomorrow, the next meeting for our group specifically is Tuesday. The next group of presenters, Michelle has been working diligently on putting the healthcare day together. Scott has been working on putting the agriculture day together. We will try to do that in a way that allows for more opportunity for discussion that I'm going to try to get out to everybody based on as the ask I've just made. And I have also asked Michelle to make sure that her folks are available for Tuesday or Thursday next week. So we have an opportunity, depending on how tomorrow goes and what feedback I get, to pivot if we need to, like we did this week. And then Scott's going to check with his group to make sure that they're available on either Thursday or the following Tuesday, so we can get the Ag Day set up. And then hospitality and tourism is something I haven't yet wrapped my brain around about how to put that day together or who could help with that. So I'll do some work on that. And if any of you have ideas on how we could do that, by all means, please let me know. Is there anything else to come before the board today?
Donnelly, I raised my hand. Joe probably didn't see it yet. It's Jim. Real quickly, are we going to dovetail mental health into the healthcare segment?
Yes, we are. Seacoast Mental Health is on deck.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Anybody else?
Donnelly.
Sorry, Jim.
Sorry, this is Michelle McEwen. Seacoast provided written comment, but it's going to be Northern Human Services that will be covering mental health and DD.
Oh, thank you, Michelle. Thank you. Okay. Anybody else? Okay. With that, thank you, everybody. My apologies that the meeting went a little bit longer today than expected, but I think it was a fruitful day and a good discussion. Look forward
thank
to hearing
you very
from
much.
Folks. Thank you.
Great meeting, Donnelly. Thank you.
Great meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You. All right. Bye, everybody.
This has been a duly noticed meeting of the Stakeholder Advisory Board to the Governor's Office of Emergency Relief and Recovery. This meeting has been recorded, and the recording will end at 4:50 p.m. Thank you very much.